This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 10th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A West Virginia primary, a dreadful economy, a maddening campaign, and an even more maddening assessment of how giant Facebook is in a position to control who and what is trending. They would never do that. But they can do whatever they want, and consumers are starting to realize that. We'll talk about that a little later this hour. But why isn't the story of what women face all over the world, violence, a trending story? If Malala wins the Nobel Prize, okay, there's a spike in coverage, but as a matter of daily coverage, no. Violence against police officers gets covered. Against women, not so much. Feminist and journalist Gloria Steinem, a pioneer who has been an outspoken champion of women's rights for more than five decades, believes that violence against women is a root cause of the global instability we see from the Middle East to right here in the United States. Steinem is the host and executive producer of a new Viceland series, Woman, which tries to depict this link and how it destroys families and communities and can disrupt society for generations to come.
It's an opportunity to be a witness. You know, I think we know that when we are in trouble, you and I or anybody else, we don't want to think that no one knows. You know, we don't want to feel invisible. So it offers the opportunity to people who otherwise could not go to the DRC or could not go to, you know, there's another one about women in prisons in this country or about Native Canadian women, or it offers a chance for them to be present and for the people in that situation to know they're being seen.
Eight weekly episodes, Steinem makes clear that the violence in faraway foreign lands that seems so untenable to many is exactly like the violence that is happening right here at home. More than 18,000 women have been killed by men since 2003.
The substance is different, but the way I have been able to do this is really thanks to the fact that I was at a conference of ideas put on by Google and talking about violence against women as an indicator of all other violence, and the fact that now for the first time there's so much violence that there are fewer females on earth than males, which probably is for the first time. Shane Smith, who is a co-inventor of Vice, was present, and he was very struck by that, very moved by that. I mean, literally moved. Shane attributes it to the fact that he has two daughters.
Yeah.
But I said to him, listen, I've said this to a lot of other people who had daughters.
Yeah.
And they weren't able to transcend sex and class and geography to empathize. And he was.
As you've stated, the premise here is that violence against women is a predictor of whether a nation will be violent within itself or use violence against another country. Does that rule not apply to the United States?
Which, it does apply to the United States.
So, I mean, certainly America's violent history in dealing with slaves and dealing with indigenous people is one thing. But do you think violence against women predicts the impulses to invade Iraq, the wars in Afghanistan, the contemporary conflicts, and the projection of American military power right now? Because so many people in the world believe that it is America that is the most violent nation.
You know, I'm not trying to reduce everything to one element. Obviously, it's extremely complex. But if you look, for instance, now at terrorist groups, I mean, for instance, I think that this and we and other countries are trying to decide who to deal with in Syria, right? The best indicator is, are women present? Are women part of those groups? How do they treat women? If we look at terrorist groups, we will see that in the extreme, you know, that they are especially brutal to women, and that is their shared characteristic.
Tell me some of the stories here in these documentaries. There was the episode in Central Africa that really you had whole communities that were based on rape.
That's the DRC, the Congo. Yeah, right. You know, it's very basic, and it's basic to the idea of masculinity, which of course gender is something we made up. It doesn't exist, like race doesn't exist, but it is inculcated in the culture so much that it gets to be a primary dictator of behavior.
So rape is a part of the war, in your view, and how this documentary presents it. It's not just some soldiers, you know, after a hard day shooting come back to a chaotic world mm-hmm. and see that there's no rules, and so they take advantage of the women.
No, it is a part of the war, and I think we saw it also in Bosnia, in all the conflicts of the former Yugoslavia, right? That it was a conscious tactic, and to the degree that soldiers are told to rape by their commanding officer. Mm-hmm. And that's not new. It's part of the conquering and humiliation process, you know, the idea of taking over the means of reproduction of the adversary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very, very basic.
Watching these documentaries, I was thinking to myself, I passed through the world, traveled a lot. I have never experienced any sense whatsoever when around women that I could be in danger of violence. Mm. Never. And it occurred to me that every woman in a situation with men can easily imagine that situation could become violent. And that is a huge contrast.
Mm-hmm.
Can that be addressed in the kinds of work that you're doing here?
Well, it's great that you are addressing it, and that will encourage other people to address it because
well,
it
I have
is,
three daughters. Shane only has two. I have three.
It is an example of programmed culture, so that the whole idea of what is masculine, what is feminine, you know, the old languages don't even have gendered pronouns. He and she, people are people. What a concept, you know. but with the sort of patriarchal cultures that try to control reproduction, we've grown up these constructs of masculine domination and female submission and so on in very deep and elaborate and different ways in different cultures, but still that overall paradigm is there. So, you know, the good news about being human is that we're adaptable. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the species survives. The bad news about being human is that we're adaptable.
So we can slip.
Yeah. And so the way we are raised causes us to think that this is the only alternative or this is necessary or we have to do this. And we can change it, of course. But in a sense, you might say that what happens to men is politics. What happens to women is called culture. But actually, mm-hmm. it's politics, too. And we can change it.
And there's a lot of talk that even within the United States, where there is a enlightened perhaps sense of equality between men and women and people of a different sexual orientation, I mean a sense of we're all together in the body politic, there's also a sexualization of media messages. I mean, my daughters and other women report that even as they feel more empowered sexually, there's also a sense that men are being taught to be more violent mm-hmm. in this culture. Are we getting better or worse globally?
Well, I think we're definitely getting better. But when you look at movements for change of almost any sort, there's resistance in the beginning. Then you overcome the beginning resistance. Then more resistance comes when you are about to become the majority. And I think that's what's happening in this country in a lot of ways because of the multiracial women's movement, because we are about to become a country that is no longer majority European-American mm-hmm. or white American. And so the people who have been raised to believe that their identity depends on being white and are in backlash, we can see that, you know, given voice by Donald Trump, you know, against the very success of the changes.
Does it concern you that many thousands, many hundreds of thousands, millions of men and women have voted with Bernie Sanders because they believe that Hillary Clinton, for her sort of progressive woman leadership identity, represents the status quo on some level, mm. and that people are impatient with the status quo, and that being a woman isn't enough for Hillary to get elected president?
Well, being a woman is never enough. I mean, you know, I wouldn't vote for Sarah Palin. You know, I mean,
I'm shocked.
So I speak up for democratic socialists, and I'm glad that Bernie Sanders is raising issues that would not otherwise be raised. He is diagnostic. Hillary Clinton is curative. if you know what I mean. I think she knows how to make it better, not just how to say what's wrong.
You, in giving a speech at Google, inspired Shane at Vice to create this Viceland series. What do you hope this series does to possibly inspire a similar kind of transformation in people who might see these stories?
Well, first of all, it's an opportunity to be a witness. You know, I think we know that when we are in trouble, you and I or anybody else, we don't want to think that no one knows. You know, we don't want to feel invisible. So it offers the opportunity to people who otherwise could not go to the DRC or could not go to, you know, there's another one about women in prisons in this country or about Native Canadian women, or it offers a chance for them to be present and for the people in that situation to know they're being seen. And the next step is, what can we do? Now, you know, there's no one thing that everybody can do, but we're offering alternatives, and I think people will find their own ways too that we've never even thought of to help alleviate the situation in some way that fits into our own lives and our own talents and abilities.
This needs to be more of a cause and less of a something happening in remote places around the world.
Yeah, it allows, you know, what allows us to empathize is our five senses. If all of us could raise one generation of children without violence, we don't know what might be possible.
Gloria Steinem, feminist and social and political activist, executive producer and host of the new Viceland series, Woman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Viceland series with Gloria Steinem airs tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern. Are you trending? Have you ever been trending? Do you plan on trending anytime soon? Just heard that Steph Curry is trending after that outrageous return to the basketball court last night.
Fires up a three, does it again!
Well, of course Steph Curry is trending. But oxygen on Mars is also trending.
Get your ass to Mars.
And MIT wrinkle smoothing treatment is trending today.
Ooh.
Trump is trending, of course.
I have to say what I have to say.
Elizabeth Warren tweeting about Trump is also trending.
We're not going to go back to bartering pigs for haircuts.
Paul Krugman talking about ignoramuses is the most emailed story on the New York Times.
Hey, Paul Krugman.
We think of all these designations as the result of a statistical measurement of interest among online users. It's math, right? Highest number of emails, clicks, page views, wins. A report at the website Gizmodo, though, says that the team in charge of selecting what's trending on Facebook is responsible for systematically omitting conservative articles and content. Facebook says it follows rigorous guidelines to ensure consistency and neutrality, and that it works to be inclusive of all perspectives. Quote, "We take allegations of bias very seriously," a Facebook spokesman said in a statement. Facebook is a platform for people and perspectives from across the political spectrum.
This is PJ calling from Montauk, New York. And my question is, do people seriously rely on Facebook for news? For news? This is Facebook, where people die and then they're not dead the next day. This is Facebook, where Lincoln makes comments about tweeting. For heaven's sakes.
This is Facebook. Well, actually, almost half of the 222 million monthly internet users do get news from Facebook, according to Pew. Where do trending stories come from? Well, it's a group of internal news curators who decides what order those stories will appear in. It's an arbitrary sounding process, but then why would we expect anything else? Jay Rosen is the author of Press Think, a blog about journalism in the digital age. He's a professor at New York University. Hello, Jay.
Hello, John.
Sean Davis is co-founder of The Federalist, a conservative online magazine. Hello, Sean.
Hi, John.
Are conservatives paranoid about what Facebook is doing to their content, or you notice something with some statistical bite behind it?
Well, I think we have seen, at least at The Federalist, we have personally experienced it. We have seen topics get driven down. We have had articles blocked or removed from being posted on Facebook. So what we saw from the admission of Facebook's own news curators confirmed what everyone in conservative publishing world already knew. Facebook's own news curators admitted, yes, we blacklist outlets and we push down trending topics that we don't like. So it's not paranoia when the people who've been doing it literally just admitted it.
Why is there an expectation that Facebook would do anything other than what it damn well pleases?
Well, in its own defense, they just said, oh, no, we have these rigorous guidelines to prevent bias, which is a non-denial denial. They never said they didn't do it. They only said they have rigorous processes in place. So why would I expect them to not be biased when they say they have processes in place to not be biased? It's kind of an odd question.
Jay Rosen, this is the tension. On the one hand, Facebook can do anything it wants to do as a private company, but as Sean suggests, they seem to believe that their brand depends on at least appearing not to be biased.
I think what's going on, although it's hard to know because they don't give us very good explanations, is Facebook wanted to start this trending news feature, and it tries to do everything it can with machines because it's run by engineers. And it couldn't produce this feature, trending news items, entirely by machines, so it switched to machine-aided curation. A list of stories that were trending was submitted to these human curators, and then they had to pick which ones belonged on the trending news. And one of their concerns, I think, was that if a phony story, a hoax that was trending, got onto the trending news list, that would be very bad for Facebook. And the contractors who were doing this work, they weren't employees, they were temporary. Facebook was trying this out, were instructed to be cautious in their picks. And when you're cautious, you rely on brand names for news. So if something pumps up from Breitbart or Red State, it's possible that the curators just didn't want to include that in trending news because it hadn't been picked up yet by the BBC or the New York Times. CBS would actually do that. Sometimes they won't run a story until the New York Times does. Even NPR might do that at a certain point.
So, Sean Davis, the idea that Facebook is going to be, you know, careful and default to picking up mainstream media is going to produce a certain kind of bias. But some conservative content producers say that when the Planned Parenthood story was going on, there was almost nothing ever trending on Facebook, and that was really suspicious. Did you note that?
Yes, we did, and we reported on it at the time. We noticed that certain articles and certain topics were not even being allowed to be posted on Facebook. Russell Moore, who heads the Ethics Public Policy Commission for the Southern Baptist Convention, a very well-respected, well-regarded theologian and commentator, he was prevented from posting his own commentary. We saw how Facebook, when it actually would put Planned Parenthood news up, in the Planned Parenthood story, the Planned Parenthood scandal was about how the organization would harvest and traffic baby body parts and organs taken from aborted healthy babies and would sell them. And Facebook would not put that when it deigned to have a trending topic. It wouldn't even put that. It would put something very anodyne, something very odd, or something that would be heavily in favor of Planned Parenthood when the reality was that 10 or 20 or 100 times as much traffic and attention was going not to Planned Parenthood's rationalization for it, but was going to the actual reporting of the story coming from numerous, numerous outlets. So, yes, we saw it.
Although, Sean, the federal courts did decide that the whole Planned Parenthood selling of body parts story was a violation of the law, was actually a felony.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. At one point, journalism was the practice of going in and finding out facts and reporting those facts. You know, when 60 Minutes goes on with a hidden camera and tells some fibs to get access to things, nobody goes and demands a fainting couch and starts to get very worried. Oh, there's some serious ethical integrity questions here.
Why does trending come with the understanding that it's supposed to be unbiased, regardless of what Facebook says about its brand? I mean, we bring this assumption to trending. Mm-hmm. Facebook doesn't necessarily bring it to trending.
Well, in a way it does, John, because all these platform companies want to be seen as technology companies and not as editorial engines. They don't describe themselves as a media company or as a news company. They want to take over the job of selecting news for users, but they don't want to be an editorial company, by which I mean they specifically don't want to be in the business of picking what stories are on the front page.
But they have a front page and they're picking stories, so therefore they're a news organization.
This is the problem. They don't want to be an editorial company, but they are serving in that role. they haven't matured enough to have an editorial culture. Did you invite the editor-in-chief of Facebook on The Takeaway this morning?
No, we did not, although we took their statement.
Because they don't have an editor-in-chief.
Right, right, exactly.
There is no such person. And this is it's like they're at a stage of development as a company where they have an editorial role, but they don't have an editorial culture. And it's very hard for them to answer questions about editorial responsibility because it's run by engineers, and engineers want the data or the algorithm or the system to drive decision making. And sometimes what happens is that they become a little bit infatuated with themselves and they think their algorithm has more power than it does, or they think the role of human judgment is smaller than it actually is.
Or they could think that they're the smartest people in the room and the stories that they pick are the ones that are true, and the stories that they hate, they're not going to put on trending topics on Facebook. I mean, we don't know what the motives are. Sean Davis, what do you think the harm is if it's actually true that there was a systematic effort to distinguish between conservative content and so-called liberal content and exclude conservative content on Facebook? What's the harm to that? Can't people who are conservative get their information from other sources?
Absolutely can. That's what's great about the internet, is that there are no, very important, powerful gatekeepers who can prevent everyone from hearing news they don't want to hear. It is important for Facebook, and it will harm them because Facebook is already facing a lot of turmoil and is really struggling within the publishing community as people start to see that, you know what, I've invested a lot of money in Facebook. I've run a lot of ads. I've gotten a lot of likes. Facebook doesn't let me really have access to my own audience. I don't know if it's a great business decision for me as a publisher to be pouring cash into Facebook when I could be using it to create content. So when you combine that concern that's already there, regardless of political affiliation, with one that, you know what, they're already discriminating against me and what I believe in and people like me believe in, why would I want to be involved with that company? Why would I want to give them money and buy ads with them? So I think this is a very serious problem for Facebook that goes far beyond kind of typical media questions about bias.
Do you think Facebook is biased, Sean?
Oh, absolutely.
Jay Rosen, do you think Facebook is biased?
Biased towards engineers.
Jay Rosen is the author of Press Think, a blog about journalism in the digital age, and a professor at New York University. Sean Davis is the co-founder of The Federalist, a conservative online magazine. Sean and Jay, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
The West Virginia primary this week will not decide anything in the presidential race, and the talk in this campaign of restoring coal, compensating unemployed miners, if anything, just aggravates the feeling that history is passing one of this state's main industries by. In 1997, a record 181,914,000 tons were produced in booming West Virginia. That was the peak. But since 2008, coal production has fallen nearly 39%. The unemployment rate hovers around 6.5%. Nationally, it's 5%. The ripple effect is being felt as teachers are being laid off. Schools are closing. So the candidates speak in rousing promises about reopening mines. Hillary Clinton has talked openly about closing down coal companies as part of her environmental strategy. And Bernie Sanders, the socialist, appeals to organized labor in his talk of economic justice, but he too believes climate change is also going to change West Virginia. What do miners think? Well, there's plenty of support for Donald Trump in this state, and also Bernie Sanders. Here's retired miner Raymond Walters.
The only person that seems to be a voice of reason in a sea of confusion is Senator Bernie Sanders. I don't know everything about him. I've not really read up on him or followed him a lot. But when I do listen and watch him, he seems to be the voice of reason out of what we have to choose from.
Sea of confusion in this election. Rick Ryan is a retired miner from Lincoln County, West Virginia. Rick, do you feel that sea of confusion this time around in 2016?
Yes, I do. It's very complicated, and there's been a lot of talk.
And who do you think miners are supporting? Who are they looking to? What rhetoric is attracting the attention of coal miners in West Virginia?
Well, Trump, he came into the state and, put a hard hat on and act like he was shoveling coal, and he said, he's going to put coal miners back to work. And a lot of people, you got to realize in this state right now, we feel like we've had the wind knocked out of us. And everybody's trying to gasp for breath, and they're trying to latch on to anything or anybody they think that can help them. And Trump come in here and he's telling everybody that he's going to put them back to work just as soon as he becomes president. You know, they're going back to work, but he's never mentioned the first time how he's going to do this. We've had Bernie Sanders come in, and if you listen to him, he doesn't want to use gas or coal. Hillary Clinton came in, and my wife and I and three other couples, we got to sit down with her for about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes. And we had an open discussion. We got to ask her anything we wanted to and tell her anything we wanted to. And we just tried to convey to her how bad of shape that the southern part of this state is and how devastated we are and what's happened to the jobs around here.
Rick Ryan, do you chart a pathway from here to a state that isn't so dependent on coal, that might have fundamentally different kinds of industries, rely maybe a lot more on tourism, manufacturing? Can you see that road ahead?
Well, I mean, we can see a little bit up now. We do have some tourism into the southern part of the state with the Hatfield-McCoy Trail Systems. It's a four-wheeler motorcycle trail system. We've got, I think it's up to like 500 or 600 miles of it right now. And they add on to that ever so often. We need more of that. People is buying onto that, putting campgrounds in, hotels, which all that helps. But we need mainline industry jobs here. You know, it's hard to replace a coal mining job when it takes 3 to 4 minimum wage jobs to replace that one job.
Is the union helping? Does the union have any strategy other than ride the industry down to the bottom of the sea?
I believe the union is open for any kind of jobs we can get into this part. You know, they know is probably better than anybody how hard this has hit.
What about your congressional delegation? I mean, can they address any of these issues? Because it doesn't sound like the presidential candidates are going to do anything other than pay lip service. And in the case of Hillary, I mean, if she does get elected, you know, that plan is part of the fine print in West Virginia. There's all kinds of other provisions in that energy plan, but you might see a benefit, you might not.
Well, you know, the way I feel right now, that's with any of the three that's running right now. You know, I hope one of them can help. You know, like I said, Trump's he's saying he can fix it overnight, and I just don't think that it's going to be fixed overnight. It's going to be something that's going to take a long, drawed-out, hard look to try to get industry back. I don't think the coal jobs will go back to where they were at just 10 years ago.
Well, Rick Ryan, have you made a decision on who you're going to vote for?
The way it's looking right now, after I got to talk to Hillary Clinton, that I guess I'm going to have to go with her.
Rick Ryan is a retired miner from Charleston, West Virginia. Thanks so much, Rick.
Thank you.
There may be a certain cruelty in this moment of political cheerleading in Charleston, West Virginia, earlier this month.
Trump digs coal. Look at that. Trump digs coal. That's true. That's true. I do.
I just think you're amazing people. And you watch what happens if I win. We're going to bring those miners back. You're going to be so proud of your president. You're going to be so proud of your country. You watch.
Donald Trump has the endorsement of the West Virginia Coal Association, who see President Obama's carbon emission regulations being challenged in the courts as a war on coal. But the war coal is fighting is against economic reality. Demand for coal is declining. The number of jobs in West Virginia has gone from about 24,700 in 2011 to 14,500 today. In the last 2 years, 6 U.S. coal companies filed for bankruptcy. Banks say they won't finance new coal-fired power plants, citing slow growth and high risk of default. Is there life after coal that the candidates should be talking about with the people of West Virginia? Tom Hansel directed the documentary After Coal. He's a filmmaker who teaches Appalachian Studies and Documentary Studies at Appalachian State University. And he says there is life after coal.
Some people have been ready to move on and diversify their economy for decades. And there are, in fact, several strong community organizations working to create a new and diverse economy. There's, I think, a really healthy movement that, with a little more support, can really help the regional economy turn the corner. I'm also concerned that we're not hearing that same level of support in the political rhetoric. We're really hearing, well, if we can just get rid of regulations, that coal jobs will come back. And I'm afraid that that's maybe an empty promise, particularly because we've heard the head of one of the largest coal companies, Arch Minerals, say, before they filed for bankruptcy, say that they were making a deliberate move out of the Appalachian coal fields, investing in the Western coal fields, because they just didn't see it being economical to produce coal in West Virginia anymore.
And yet Donald Trump says, Trump digs coal, Trump digs coal. I think you're amazing people, looking at miners, the Democrats saying similar sorts of things, offering billions of dollars in aid to fossil fuel workers in their communities, job retraining. Even Bernie Sanders, who's very pro-climate change and moving away from fossil fuels, has attracted a lot of attention in West Virginia because he appeals to the working class. What explains all of that?
Well, I think there is somewhat of a nostalgia of the coal industry and the good old days and full employment. Really, one of the basic things that you can see is that there actually is a role of government to play. It's not just private industry. And where you can see the government playing a successful role is in the reclamation of mine sites. That it's really difficult to do any kind of economic development or community development if you don't have a consistent source of clean water.
Why haven't we heard rhetoric about reclamation? We hear rhetoric about retraining and, you know, compensation and those sorts of government welfare programs for people who are affected by mine closures, but nothing about economic development in those sorts of sustainability terms where you're reclaiming land, restoring water, and allowing the communities to rebuild on their own.
I think those are the kind of details that maybe don't make the neat sound bites and may miss out on the stump speeches. I actually do think if you look at what's called the Power Plus plan that was part of Obama's budget proposal, there is actually money to spend out of the Abandoned Mine Lands Fund on reclamation. And I believe there's a way that that plan connects mine reclamation along with retraining or employing former miners to do the mine reclamation, to provide the foundation for sustainable development.
Tom Hansel directed the documentary After Coal. He teaches Appalachian Studies and Documentary Studies at Appalachian State University. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Traveling down that coal town road, listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye and White Sycamore. I'm leaving you behind.
Hillary Clinton on the L word, leadership.
We are meeting at a time of unprecedented opportunity and achievement for women. As you've already heard, women are serving at the highest levels of government here in the United States and around the world, in business and academia and the professions. We are presiding over companies and colleges, running philanthropies and laboratories, and breaking new ground as artists and activists and athletes.
From that commencement speech at Barnard College in 2009, Secretary of State Clinton has had to fight to be heard. As a candidate for president and the Democratic Party front runner, she's had to prove she has the leadership skills to face her insurgent challenger Bernie Sanders and populist wildcard on the GOP side, Donald Trump. In the middle of this campaign, cognitive psychologist Dr. Therese Houston decided to re-examine some common assumptions about how women make decisions and the men that keep those stereotypes going. Her conclusions are in the book, How Women Decide, What's True, What's Not, and What Strategies Spark the Best Choices.
There are three qualities that people think are essential in a good leader. They need to be intelligent, they need to be honest, and they need to be decisive. And of those three qualities, there was a very large gap between men and women on the quality of what people perceived around decisiveness. And the perception was that men were more decisive than women.
Is it your view that in the current workforce and in so many professions where males dominate, that women have the tools that they need to compete, and that partly this book is about giving women tools to remind them that they actually have all the tools that they need?
I love the idea that we are empowering women to take their proper seats at the table. And that's one of the things that Sheryl Sandberg encourages throughout her book. And what we need to talk about now is, how are women going to be treated when they take their seats at the table? One of the findings I find most fascinating is around stress and risk-taking. The common perception is that in stressful circumstances, women will become emotional and fall apart, whereas men remain calm and level-headed. What researchers are finding first is that when cortisol levels run high, on average, men can become more laser-focused on rewards, which means they're more willing to take high risks more often under stressful circumstances. Picture, you know, a Hail Mary pass in the very end of a close football game. Potential for a big win, potential for a big mistake to happen. Under the same stressful circumstances, women become more interested in the sure small wins that can be taken and pretty much guaranteed. And it gives us a real reason to have both men and women in the room, rather than the typical model at so many organizations, which is you look around the table and it's only men who are sitting there who get the final say.
I'm actually more comforted by someone who, under stress, as you've suggested, women, you know, look around and make sure everyone's okay, making sure that the small things aren't missed. That seems like something you'd want far more than the Hail Mary pass person, although it might be entertaining to have them in the room.
And that's the interesting thing that I think we often miss, is that what makes for great entertainment, that high risk-taking surge that we love to watch, is not necessarily what we want in our politicians or our bankers or our school superintendents or someone who runs a hospital, right? In terms of those situations, we want people who are alert to the risks, not people who are just focused on the possible rewards that have a small chance of materializing.
What's your sense of Hillary Clinton's learning curve on leadership? You know, her life is so exposed, and now she's, you know, running for president and looks likely to get pretty darn close. What's your sense of her decision-making skills and how much she may have had to learn over the course of her career?
So I certainly would not want to be in her shoes in terms of the amount of pressure and the amount of scrutiny that she's receiving. I think an important thing to remember is that the presidency is traditionally a male job. Men have occupied that role in this country for over 225 years. And a researcher at Yale University, she led a team that looked at how we judge leaders who occupy a role that's usually held by the other gender. And what she found was that when a female leader makes a mistake in a traditionally male job, people think that she has poor judgment and they want to demote her. They scrutinize her much more than a male leader in that same role who makes the exact same mistake. So that suggests to me that people are going to be much more critical of Hillary Clinton than they would be of a male candidate who makes the same mistake. They're going to be more forgiving of him.
How do you think Hillary Clinton might be in a position to change that perception if she's successful?
I'm not sure what Hillary Clinton can do, because it's tricky when she raises the issue that there might be bias. People don't like hearing that from her, at least, or from the person who feels that the bias is working against them. But I do believe that by having this conversation about women as decision makers, that we can begin to notice biased reporting in the news. When people use the phrase, you know, it's a woman's prerogative to change her mind, to stop using that phrase. What I'm excited about is that we've been having a conversation about gender bias in this country for several years now, and we have an opportunity to see how we've been censuring and penalizing women around their decisions, and we shouldn't be. We can learn to see it for the equal weight that it has with men making the same decision.
Finally, what opportunities do you think have been consistently missed by either not understanding the way women make decisions or not valuing the ways in which women make decisions?
I think one of the opportunities that's being missed is that if we had more women in top decision-making roles, we might be seeing fewer of these crises. Women tend to pivot towards the risks and men tend to pivot towards the possible rewards. And if we had more balance of the two genders, what we might see is more balanced decisions and fewer of these crises arising. This is a lesson that we can see again and again in the research. If we have men and women genuinely participating in the decision process, better decisions can be made.
All right, Therese, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much, John. It's a real treat.
Therese Houston is the author of How Women Decide What's True, What's Not, and What Strategies Spark the Best Choices. It's out today. And here's something to take with you today. I thought I'd just check over to see what's trending right now on Facebook. Mars Oxygen right at the top. John Stewart calling Donald Trump a man baby. That's second. An argument over King Tut. That's down a couple of spots. Over on Twitter, the trending topic is Hiroshima, where the president will visit later this month. That was announced today. But Pokemon Sun Moon also trending. And Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors. Of course, Steph Curry is trending. But here's a clear sign of manipulation. Trending on Facebook right now, scientists find new magnetic behaviors in topological insulator materials. Jay Rosen said on this program this hour that Facebook was biased toward engineers. Topological insulator materials? I think it's pretty clear. He's onto something. Subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And please give us a rating. You can like us. You can love us. You can love and like us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. We're trending. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.